This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 18. And I'm delighted to be joined on the show today by Karen Kerrigan, Legal and Finance Director at Cedars, who are the first equity crowdfunders to be FCA authorised in the UK. Karen is also a director of the UK Crowdfunding Association, and so a perfect person to give us a 30,000 feet overview of the equity crowdfunding scene. I first met Karen at a breakout group at the London Financial News FinTech Day last autumn. I was impressed by her passion for ensuring that all categories of investor, private through to VC, always get equal treatment. I was also clear that, in a group which also included folks from the likes of Deutsche Börse, that there needed to be some convergence between the new equity platforms and the old ones. What do I mean by that? Well, over the decades / centuries, institutions can ossify. Although there has been much activity since I told a bank CEO about 25 years ago that there would be such activity, and he told me there never would be, another wasted prophecy of mine, I must have been Cassandra in a prior life, the rules and regs as such of the old institutions are rarely slimmed down. Vice versa, due to an overly tech approach, perhaps, the need for rules and regs are not always appreciated by online equity fundraisers. FinTech is not tech is one of my maxims, and perhaps crowdfunding is a prime example. In a world of 1,001 classes of shares and VCs who are adept at arbitraging such, private investors definitely need appropriate protection. I'll include a link in the show notes to a blog article Karen wrote in this context about all sorts of important things like preemption rights, tag-along and consent rights. You see what I mean about fintech is not tech. Anyway, no chance of this at Cedars, a company stuffed to the gunnels with lawyers. A recent advert I saw for an investment director at Cedars specified, must be a lawyer. Pleasingly for my recent Occupy FinTech hashtag campaign, it also specified something about work-life balance. So maybe they're losing some of their lawyerly vibe, as lawyers are renowned for loving the 25-hour day, or if not exactly loving it, then at least working it. Finally, before we dive into the show, I'd like to share a small story about Karen and Jeff Lynn, co-founder and CEO of Cedars. When chatting to Karen about the London FinTech podcast, she kindly, and greatly to her credit, offered up Jeff, who was a great speaker. However, I'm keen not just to end up interviewing a CEO every week, but to give a platform to anyone with a real passion for FinTech and knowledge thereof. Also, in a FinTech world with a huge shortage of women, I'm also keen to help diminish the crazy notion that somehow it's not for women. Anyway, I left it to Karen to speak to Jeff. Personally, I'd be happy to talk to either. Jeff, and much to his credit too, 9 CEOs out of 10 perhaps would hog the limelight at this stage, let Karen take the gig. It's very much a sign of a great CEO that they not only recruit the best people, and that's far rarer in the city than it used to be, but are also happy to have their team out there representing the firm. So let's get on with the show. Hi Karen, thanks for joining me today.
No problem at all, Mike. Thanks for having me. I like your maxim that fintech's not really tech. I'm probably one of the least techie people you'll have met over the course of doing the podcast.
Actually, I think it's more people are realising as business is getting to scale-ups that fintech is about business.
Yes.
Which needs tech to happen sometimes.
I agree.
The business needs to come first. I think it's a lot of the startups that go into the accelerator program start from a tech perspective and slowly work out that it's about business, and FFs is a little bit more complicated. So when Louise Beaumont was on the show, we covered the whole gender issue that I mentioned. My favourite quote from a fintech woman, when I asked her what the barriers were, replied none. However, I realised that with you on the show, there's a massive bias in that I've met very, very few fintechers who are modern pentathletes. Do we need affirmative action to get more in?
Very good. I like your research. I'm usually quite good at keeping a low online profile, not that that's very good in the tech scene, but there are a few references to modern pentathlon out there.
So do you still do it then?
I don't. I haven't competed probably for about 8 years now, but it was rather fun. They call it the James Bond sport. It's got fencing, shooting, running, swimming and show jumping.
Yeah, it's got all the very sort of she expensive ones in it.
Quite.
I was wondering the other day actually why there wasn't a quadrathlon.
There's a tetrathlon.
Oh, a tetrathlon. I really like the winter biathlon, the shooting and skiing. I watched every race of that. And then obviously there's a triathlon, there's a pentathlon, and you're the modern one, and there's an old fashioned one, but the modern one is 100 years old.
Correct.
And then there's a heptathlon and a decathlon. So what's the quadrathlon then?
So the tetrathlon is everything in the pentathlon except for fencing. So it's shooting, swimming, running, and show jumping.
Okay, well, so we learned something today.
We had quite a lot of old tetrathletes that would come and start doing pentathlon, who were always very good. Problem is getting the boys who ride.
I have daughters who sort of ride horses, but fortunately they haven't quite yet got into the problem of getting boys who ride.
The boys have a quite interesting way of teaching themselves to show jump. It's never to learn to ride. It's always sort of clinging onto the horse for dear life and just getting them over the jump, which is quite a spectator sport.
We're talking of obscure sports and gender discrimination. Going back to strange sports, of course, there's a massive difference in lacrosse between women's lacrosse and men's lacrosse, in that women's lacrosse, you're not allowed to beat each other up.
No, that's true. And I actually played mixed lacrosse at university.
Oh, really?
A little bit, having done
so
a bit
of it. So
you
did get beaten up.
Yes, and I played it at school, and I was at an all-girls school, which was terribly civilised.
Yeah. It's a non-contact sport.
Exactly.
I used to know the guy who was captain of the Cambridge lacrosse, and he was a tough guy, and he'd come back black and blue.
Yeah.
I also happened to know the captain of the ice hockey team. We were both living on the same staircase, and he would come back black and blue as well. Okay, so going on to not leaving our investors black and blue, what a segue, hey? Crowdfunding, as we were just discussing, one of the problems is vocabulary in this fintech sector. Crowdfunding means many things to many people. I tend myself to associate it with equity, although some people associate the word crowdfunding with the whole alternate finance sector. So maybe you can talk a little bit about the equity crowdfunding, where it came from, and some of this vocabulary problem.
Yes. So maybe this is a good time to talk about the UK Crowdfunding Association, which essentially is a trade body for all different types of crowdfunding. And by that, I mean us, the equity players, so people that raise investment in exchange for shares or equitable interest in the company. Then you've got debt, which incorporates the peer-to-peer lenders, and I know you've spoken to quite a few of them, and the debt-based securities, so people like Abundance Generation who do long-term debentures. And then it also looks at the rewards and donations-based crowdfunding, which are the more charitable side of things as opposed to your capitalist equity and debt platforms. So the UK Crowdfunding Association, we take on members that fall into any of those four sectors. The Peer-to-Peer Finance Association has its own members, which are strictly peer-to-peer finance, but we're a little bit more of a community, let's say.
Right. So one of the things that's happening as this fintech scene matures is of course, there's a Darwinian struggle going on from the association level.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of that. And I think the FCA has actually inadvertently entered that debate. When the policy statement that the FCA recently did on crowdfunding came out, all the players in the market expected a debt consultation, so one that dealt with peer-to-peer, and then an equity consultation that dealt with the likes of Cedars. And what came out was a crowdfunding consultation, which dealt with the peer-to-peer guys, calling them loan-based platforms, and then the equity guys, calling them equity-based platforms.
Ah, right. Yes, I saw that, and that did confuse me massively. I thought, why is the FCA using the word crowdfunding to mean the whole of alternate finance? So anyway, so that's something that's going to be resolved over time in terms of all these organisations fighting it out to the death, or at least carving the territory up, and the FCA and all the rest of us using the same vocabulary as each other. So where did equity crowdfunding as such come from? When didn't it exist, and who was the sort of first person who did it, as it were?
So Jeff and Carlos, Jeff Lynn and Carlos Silva, are our two co-founders, and I think they probably had the idea around the same time as Luke and Darren at Crowdcube. And that was in around 2009. And I'll speak to Jeff and Carlos's story, given that that's the one I know.
And that was a few years after Giles and co at Zopa invented it.
Exactly. So I think Zopa came in about 2005, exactly, and Funding Circle a little bit later than that. And Jeff and Carlos met at business school up in Oxford. Jeff is an ex-US securities lawyer, and Carlos is an ex-tech expert. And they were very impressed.
So isn't he a tech expert anymore then?
We hope he is. We hope he is.
Exactly.
But they were very impressed at what the debt players were doing and wondered if they could do the same for equity, so mini venture capital online, and looked at what the model was for the debt platforms and applied it to startups, realised that startups were not really in a position to take on debt, so looked at doing the equitable side. And crowdfunding, equitable crowdfunding, is a way for companies, early stage businesses, to raise money from their peers, their consumers, their friends and family, other investors, you know, angels and even venture capitalists, and aggregate them all on a platform in quite a clean online way.
And then you guys were, as I mentioned up front, the first people to be registered by the FCA for equity crowdfunding, which certainly took quite a period of time. Other players in the market proceeded regardless. But that's all kind of water under the bridge now. And I can't, off the top of my head, remember any sort of statistics about how much money is raised per annum or has been raised or that kind of thing. When you come into Cedars, you come into a wall full of sort of pictures of all the various deals you've done, which is quite impressive.
Yeah. So do you want me to talk to you about the authorisation process or just straight in with
that? As I'm not a lawyer, I probably wouldn't get as excited as you would about this, the process. Let's just stick with the market for the moment.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So at the moment, I think we're the most active platform across Europe and we're raising, on average, about 10 deals per month, which is pretty good. And that's about €2 million invested per month in Cedars.
Right. And having said I'm not interested in authorisation, then obviously one thing that you say there implies that if you're FCA registered, then the passporting works around Europe. Does it? Or are you just raising UK companies? Can you do German ones?
Most of our companies have been UK-based. We started off purely as a UK-based platform. In November 2013, we expanded to Europe. Currently, we're taking a bit of a light approach to Europe, which is definitely going to be accelerated this year. And we're not using the passport. We're focused in the UK in terms of all our investment activity takes place in the UK. So we're not actually using a passport at this stage. But we have enabled a Belgium company to raise money on Seeders, a Croatian incubator has raised money on Seeders, and we've also done a Cypriot company.
When they're raising those, is it a bit like in old money, people coming to London Stock Exchange and listing in London, using the listing word?
Exactly. So that's what's happening currently on the site.
Because obviously from a digital perspective, you said at your computer, it doesn't matter which company, and you go www.seeders.com, you know, it looks like the kind of placeless internet.
Yeah. No, from regulatory purposes, the important thing itself is the investment activity which is taking place in the UK.
Right.
But as I said, that may change next year when we start to sort of be a bit more aggressive in our approach to Europe. And we certainly haven't ruled out setting up offices elsewhere, but that's not our focus right now. And as you rightly pointed out, we've now acquired a US platform, which is very exciting.
Yeah, we'll come to the US one later. I'm just trying to sort of think off the top of my head about how this listing thing works in the digital age, because again, going back to when I started in the city, it was all much simpler. Whatever it was called, the German Stock Exchange was in Germany. Mm. The UK was in the UK. And there's no way you could ever confuse that, because there was a building in London and that was it. But of course, these days you have buildings, but also you've got the interweb out there. Mm.
I think it still has a lot to do with physical presence, having language-based platforms, so translations of the platforms in other countries, and whether you are actively sort of recruiting investors.
And going back to you being a lawyer, it's also presumably very important which law applies.
Yes, so all our contracts are under UK law, right, or okay. Investment activities.
So going back to ideas of expanding around Europe, you can expand as you are at the moment, or the other thing is that you could kind of go native, as it were, and raise money for German companies in Germany under German law, or something like that.
Yeah, although in that situation, you would then be regulated by the German crowdfunding laws, right, which are incredibly prohibitive at this stage.
There's
a lot of noise about that at the moment.
That's good, it keeps the competition down. I also remember reading and tweeting last autumn about the fact that most fintech is actually illegal in Korea, so that stops them competing as well. So there's probably quite a good point to come on to why the UK is doing so well, actually, as we're talking about sort of geography. I assume we're doing very well, because I always read that in the newspapers.
Well, both the UK government and the UK regulator are incredibly supportive of crowdfunding and peer-to-peer and all alternative finance, really, particularly in the wake of the financial crisis and everything they did to remedy the financial crisis. So I think there's quite a policy objective in supporting crowdfunding and other types of alt-fi. But the basis of the regulation is principles. So as opposed to somewhere like Germany, when they've really gold-plated the legislation, and in America, where they've prohibited crowdfunding to normal investors, the UK's structure is just a little bit more flexible. So if you look at the actual activities that equity crowdfunding platforms do, they have always been regulated. Now, we've mentioned how difficult it was to get Seeders FCA authorised, or how long it took. It doesn't mean that it's easy to fit your square peg in the round hole, but it's certainly possible. And the consultation paper earlier last year really showed that the FCA wanted to try and accommodate these platforms and support where they could with proportionate legislation. So we've just got to make sure that they keep doing that.
Yes, I mean, it's always the case that if you're the first through any process, whether you're an older child trying to get back home later and all that kind of thing, it's much easier for the ones who are follow-on.
Yes, yes.
And it wouldn't take somebody 18 months now, I assume.
Martin Wheatley, who's the chief executive of the SCA, actually it was the event that we met at,
yes, I think.
Gave his speech.
He was saying how they're here to help.
Exactly.
And afterwards, at the sort of champagne drinks, which you miss because you often see some 1970s rock band or something like that. The champagne was quite nice. I met lots of 20-somethings who said, oh, it's so wonderful, the regulator's here to help and all that kind of stuff. And I said, yes, it is great. He's here to help today and all that kind of thing. But if it fucks up in 5 years' time, there'll be a different bloke who isn't here to help.
Yeah, well, he chose his wording very carefully. And what Wheatley was launching that day was the Project Innovate, which is supposed to help innovators, so financial innovators, launch and get their companies or businesses authorised easier than the process that Seeders went through, in an easier way. Whether or not that will actually come to fruition is a different matter. we basically had to build an entire platform before going to the regulator. Yeah. And I think Project Innovate has the intention of letting people ask questions and get pencil sign-off at an earlier stage. And, you know, what Wheatley won't do is sign off in pen at those early stage, but it's supposed to give
us a bit more
freedom.
His lawyers wouldn't let him either.
Exactly.
No, absolutely. I'm not being cynical. I think that the UK as a whole and the regulators are doing a brilliant job at the moment of trying to facilitate this, and it's been working very well. And one of the points you were mentioning concerns me slightly, because I think it's the right way to do it, but I've seen this song before and I kind of know how it ends, which is that you say that started with principle-based regulation. And I recall in the, I think it was the 1980s, the TSA, which was a forerunner of all these kind of things, the Securities Association, as it was then called, and when regulation just started to come after Big Bang, it started with principles, and maybe even the FSA started with some principles, some high-level principles, which is a very English approach. And, of course, over time, that lost out massively in two directions. One, to the kind of European Napoleonic Code, where we're going to define everything. And secondly, the American excess of lawyers, in which we're going to arbitrage anything that's written down. And so we went from equity regulation, of equity markets being a sheet of A4, to it being a vast thing where you need vast teams of lawyers to get through it. So it would be nice if it sticks with the principles. I think I'm a little bit concerned that sort of history shows that even if the UK market does stick with principles approach, other people will turn up and want everything defined.
Yes, and maybe I misrepresented that slightly. Whilst there are principles, there are certainly hard rules based on those principles.
Okay. So this is a young person's version of principles. This is the 21st century principles, as opposed to the old-fashioned, look, thou shalt be a good chap, like
yes.
stockbrokers always used
yes,
to be.
Exactly. And don't forget, we also have the effects of Europe, who like to actually sort of make a lot more sort of firm pillars.
No, indeed. This is what I mean about the Napoleon's revenge in terms of this whole Napoleonic code, that everything has got to be defined. And you mentioned Germany, and Germany's always had the same attitude as well, which works very well if you're making BMWs and Audis, because everything does need to be defined. But going back to the 90s, when Kleinwort was overtaken by the Dresdner Bank, once we started to engage, which was roughly 12 months after we got married, we found that basically you couldn't do anything in Dresdner Bank because they had so many rules that basically everything was prohibited. And they realised that, and the way to get around that was that you got a Vorstand, you got a main board member, who could say, oh yeah, but you can do it anyway. So you just need a Vorstand signature. So, of course, we had a friendly Vorstand guy who would sort of sign off and everything, and then we could do what we like in the sort of kind of good chap way that we did. But I'm not entirely sure in the modern world that there is this exemption from a never-ending increase in bureaucracy and regulation, which is only a one-way path.
Yeah, you're probably right. Let's hope that it doesn't end that way.
Anyway, it's not a problem for the moment because
no.
You've got lots of companies coming through your platform.
Exactly. And you know, the bit in the consultation paper that came out was very brief in terms of equity platforms. As I said, it basically just reaffirmed what we're doing and the fact that we should be regulated. But there was a sort of PS at the bottom which says, we'll look at this again in 2016. So the message is there, behave, or there'll be some more bars put around you, probably.
Absolutely, and it's a very active topic. I mean, using your association's definition of crowdfunding as sort of anything in the UK economy, or a slightly narrower version of that, because on the debt side, the government has decided that banks cannot say go away, I normally say something else, to SMEs. They have to say go away to, and send them to an alternate finance platform. So this whole quality control issue is a very live one for 2015. And I think going back to the meeting that with Deutsche Börse and other sort of sensible people around there, I guess that in an ideal world, the best way is if these associations / the FCA together can come up with some sensible rules which keep the game stable and stop it blowing up in the first place. And then you avoid all the sort of slamming the stable door after horses bolted regulation, which just piles on top.
Yeah, but there, you know, there's still room for a resource for people to go to work out which type of funding is good for them, is suitable for them. And I think the tough thing for especially people starting new businesses, is that repeated reject. So going to your bank, which rejects you, going to an investment community, which rejects you, and not having anywhere to go and not knowing where the best place to go is. So I think what the government's suggesting in terms of the banks referring on is not a bad one, but how do you do that? How do you do that without forcing a bank to do something?
Absolutely. That's a very active thing. And going back to this concept that these new sexy fintechy equity platforms on the one hand, and on the other hand the old quotes boring stock exchanges like the London Stock Exchange or AIM or Deutsche Börse or whatever, that going forwards there needs to be some convergence. What's your thought around that?
Convergence
between the two. So I would assume that in 5 years' time, a Cedars or a Crowdcube, something which is running some kind of equity marketplace, it will look a little bit more like a stock exchange and the stock exchange would have to sexed up a little bit. Otherwise, everybody would just go through these alternate platforms because it's a million times easier. That's a hypothesis.
No, and I think you're right that there's definitely a challenge coming up through these alternative players. I mean, at the end of last year, in September, October time, we helped a publicly listed company, Chapel Down, raise money through Cedars.
And that was a seven-figure sum.
It was 3.95 million from about 1,500 different investors. And Chapel Down did this intentionally. I mean, they're listed on the ISDEX growth market. And
on the which one?
On the ISDEX growth market.
Which one's that? Sorry.
So it's the kind of secondary ISDEX market, okay. The ISDX market, which is run by ICAP, and generally for kind of growth companies coming up. And last time they raised money, they did it from institutions, but this time it was a very intentional strategy, really, to try and get customer acquisition, marketing, and publicity, along with getting investor participation. So they did it on Cedars, and it was incredibly successful, and they were pleased with the results. And I'm sure our fees were a darn sight lighter touch than what you get from going out to market. So I think there is a real challenge there. And we really showed that you can use crowdfunding either alongside an institutional raise or instead of an institutional raise, particularly with consumer-focused brand products.
Yeah, so as you say, the advisory part is a challenge on the debt, but also it's going to be increasingly a challenge on the equity side. So your corporate financiers are going to have a huge choice to advise their finance directors over raising money here, there, or somewhere else.
But I think linking into that over the next months, years, we will start seeing those sorts of players actually have to start reassessing their fees for what they're doing, yeah, and have to justify them and be more transparent about them. Because if there's one thing that online platforms are, is transparent. You can see exactly what we do over what period of time and what success we have.
Absolutely. So in terms of the case of the Chapel Down that you mentioned, I mean, one of the things it reminds me of is that Kickstarter and reward-based schemes in the States are increasingly attracting a reputation of being a kind of marketing scheme as much as anything else. People going to Kickstarter for a marketing campaign for awareness rather than raising the money. Another aspect I was going to ask you about in terms of the numbers of investors that they got, we hear a lot about the democratization of finance and any entrepreneur with a good idea can go to one of these sites and raise money. And that's certainly true. And there's this thing called social proof, which is if I go and stick London FinTech Podcast on Cedars next month and raise a million for expansion or drinking champagne or whatever, then it's not exactly build it and they will come. It's not that people suddenly flood to it. There's this social proof, and I don't know what the numbers are, you can tell me, but I need to get 30% or so of my friends and relatives, because otherwise people look at that and goes, oh my God, even his friends and relatives don't invest in it. So yeah. How does that kind of work then?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is there's not a magic number. I think that's partly our fault, actually, because back in mid-2013, we'd looked at what we'd been doing for the last year. And it seemed to be that once you got over about 30%, that was your tipping point on average. Now, that varies hugely from company to company. But the key takeaway from that, and as you said, a lesson learned from Kickstarter, is that you need to generate your community to have interest in your business. Yeah. You know, we always say, if your mum won't back you, why should I? And the more that you can input into that momentum at the very beginning, the more that other investors are going to be excited about it. And on Cedars, we have a huge base of investors who, if they're regular investors and regular Cedars users, won't invest from day 1 to 30 and will wait to see until there's some real interest. I mean, a great company that's just raised money on Cedars is a company called Oppo, who do healthy ice cream. Apparently one of their little pots of ice cream.
Oh, I think I've seen them. Are they the ones that do the Brazilian recipe or something?
Exactly. So it was two brothers who are the founder entrepreneurs, and apparently they discovered this while kite surfing in North Brazil.
Which, in passing, Rupert Taylor of LFP010 is also a kite surfer in Northern Brazil.
As am I.
Oh, you're a kite surfer. Was... My God, I'm so unfashionable.
Which is why I was very attracted to them when I first met them, or attracted to,
right,
to them as entrepreneurs. Well, exactly.
I know that lawyers and fintech people never take a holiday, but I never imagine you're out there sort of doing deals on the beach.
No, we didn't meet in northern Brazil, unfortunately. But they did kite surf along the same beach that I did. But they actually kite buggied. And the legend is they ran out of food and sort of started eating guava and coconuts and all these kind of things, and developed this recipe where the little pot of ice cream has fewer calories than an apple. Anyway, that's the sort of brand promotion, which probably they should be doing. But they're now selling in Waitrose and an Ocado. And, you know, they launched on Cedars, and within, I think it was minutes, hours, they got their full investment target, which was 100 grand. And they've eventually taken 300
grand. There must be lots
grand.
Of sort of Brazilian kite surfers with loads of money who
want to... exactly. But I think the messages from this, they used it as a marketing opportunity. They wanted all their consumers to take a bit of their business so that they bought in. And equally, they wanted their investors to become consumers.
It's an extension of building the tribe in a Seth Godin fashion.
Exactly.
That's very interesting. And that then takes me on to the promotion of equity raising. And we'll come on to the States in a minute. But in the US, I think one of the difficulties is promoting it. And I think the last time the SEC spoke about the 1930s regulation was in the 80s or something. I think I heard your CEO talk about this. And they were then saying, oh, yes, you can only tell connected people like your chums at the golf club or something like that. How does it work in the UK at the moment? I mean, you know, are you guys allowed to go around saying, hey, buy shares in this ice cream company? Or?
The latest statement from the FCA is really just as it always has been. And last year they reaffirmed that you could only market your product and it has to be signed off by an FCA authorised person. So your fundraising campaign on Cedars is your financial promotion, and you direct people to that campaign. And to get on to Cedars and see that offer and be able to invest, you have to be a high net worth, a sophisticated investor, or you have to prove that you've got the requisite knowledge, experience and expertise to understand the risks. And as long as the platform communicates that understanding of the risk clearly to the investors, then the FCA are okay with that, which is a much more mature way of thinking than in the States, where the current position is you can only invest if you're rich.
Yeah. So here then, it really helps to be rich, but you can get around the regulation somehow otherwise.
You just have to prove that you understand you will lose all your money if the company fails, which is the real risk.
How do I prove that then?
So on Cedars, we pioneered this test when we became authorised back in 2012. And the test basically asks people about the risks of investing in startup and deals with the key questions such as loss of capital.
So there's a little tick box and I go, yes, I know I'll lose the lot. And that makes me an expert investor.
No, there's a few different questions. Right. So deals with diversification, deals with dilution, deals with loss of capital and sort of the key risks that the FCA deems to be related to investing in early stage businesses.
Oh, okay. Well, as you say, that's even sort of fairly sensible, doesn't it? Maybe it's a good point to come on to this thing that I can never kind of remember what all these tag along preemption rights, blah, 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 are. But going back to arbitraging the law, there's all these different classes of shares and VCs, private equity people, absolute past masters at making sure they get the best deal and other people don't. And as I said, that's when you caught my attention with your passion that you didn't want that to take place at Cedars. So briefly, without getting into 1,001 classes of share, how does one kind of look after the average investor and make sure they don't get, financial phrase here, screwed by people who come along later? Give an example, I mean, like all of us do these days, you get emails from your mate saying, oh yeah, invest in us, and it was a successful fundraiser on another platform I won't mention. But this original email came to me, I was incredibly busy, and it was B shares. And I thought, hang on, what's this about, you know, or something like that. And I just didn't have time to get into the detail, and they didn't explain it. So having a little bit of a background in financial services, I was a bit sort of sniffy about that, so I just avoided it. But how's this whole thing approach from your perspective? How do you look after investors who aren't there sort of sticking their elbows out?
I'll just take a step back on that. And on a successful raise, you will get a company who has raised 100,000, 200,000, 300,000 from 100 investors, 200 investors, 300 investors. Now, it's absolutely impossible and just unworkable for the company to have 300 investors on their shareholder register, to send out notices to all those people, to take votes from all those people, to give them all voting shares. And the platforms have dealt with this in different ways. And the platform that you've encountered has dealt with this by giving B shares to people that probably only invest a small amount of money so that they don't have to deal with the administration of it.
And pressing pause on that came very simplistically. When the company comes to decide what its dividend is, it could give one dividend to the A's and one to the B's.
Correct. Or may not give a dividend to the B. Exactly.
So you're utterly taking on the trust that not just the current management, but any future management of that company will treat you pari passu with the A's, which it may not.
Correct. And also, I mean, you've got to think about what your rights as an A shareholder or a B shareholder will be defined in the articles.
Yeah.
And those articles,
which is why I couldn't be bothered to drill into the detail.
Exactly. And those articles can be changed as a 75% majority. At Cedars, we deal with that in a different way. We want to give all our investors A shares, all our investors voting shares, and we want them all to have exactly equal rights. At the end of the day, we're in this game because we want the companies to succeed and we want the investors to make a return. Now, the way that we do that without the company ending up with 300 shareholders on its shareholder register is by acting as a nominee shareholder. So all the investors that invest on Cedars are caught under the Cedars umbrella, and then we invest on their behalf. Now, every time that there's a vote, we vote in the best interests of the underlying investors, unless they want to vote by proxy, which they're totally entitled to request. And what it gives us leverage to do, because we might hold, you know, 10, 20% of the company, is to enter into a professional grade subscription agreement with the company. And that has all the terms and protections that you would expect if you were a venture capitalist, if you're an angel investor, which includes preemption, tag along, consent rights. So, for example, if they want to issue preference shares or increase director salaries, they come to us and generally we'll say yes. I mean, if it's in the best interest of the company and the company is going to grow by taking those actions, we'll say yes. But if they want to, you know, issue 1 million shares to their mum, we won't.
Yeah. So in simple terms, if you're a small investor in a company, whether you've gone through an online thing or not, on your own, you've got bugger all influence on the company. I told the story in a previous episode. I invested in BES, which was the 90s version of this kind of stuff, and most BESs went bust. My investment in my BS is still there 20 years later, and I can't get it back. And nor can my buddy, who's the second largest shareholder in the company, because of how it all works. So it's very easy to put your money into equity things, and it's much harder to influence it going forward. So there's the small shareholder problem, but then also, as you're pointing out, there's the fact that there are lots of clever lawyers and capitalists around in the world who, after you've invested, might do things which aren't in your interest. So what I've always understood about Cedars and what you're saying now, it basically amounts to the fact that if you're investing through your platform, you or my mum or anybody actually basically get upgraded to kind of VC caliber protection. You know, it's like you're going in with a sort of cardboard shield and a cardboard sword, but actually you go through you guys and you guys give them a proper suit of armour.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Oh, good. So we agree then. Perfect. Perfect. OK, well, come on later to the question of how much you charge for doing all these kind things for people. And then just very briefly, I always lose track of these things myself. So there were these EIS and SEIS, I can't quite remember. And there's all these, you know, percentages of tax relief. And just briefly, how does that work? Because some people who are listening to the show, like me, are very forgetful and can't quite remember. And off the top of my head, there's something absolutely crazy. And if I stick £1,000 into your platform, blah, 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 and it never works out or something like that, then somehow I don't lose it all because of the income tax and the capital gains, etc.
That's correct. So,
which is amazing, of course.
Yeah, probably about 90% of our UK companies which are raising money on Cedars are either EIS or SEIS eligible. So it's the Enterprise Investment Scheme, which is a scheme that's been running for quite a long time, and then the Seed Enterprise Investment Scheme, which came in a couple of years ago. Now, if you invest in an EIS eligible company, you'll be able to get 30% off the amount of your investment in your next income tax bill. In addition, anything that you make on that company when the shares are sold is capital gains tax free. In SEIS, so earlier stage businesses, that changes to 50% off your income tax.
Right, so I invest $100, then $50 is deducted from tax.
Only in pounds, but otherwise that's correct.
I've turned American, I say dollars all the time, but yeah. Okay, so I invest £100, so basically, or put another way, as long as I'm paying income tax, then the government will pay half the investment for me.
Exactly.
And won't tax me when I make a profit.
Exactly.
Excellent. Very good. No wonder we're ahead. So what do you think are the main challenges going forwards for the marketplace as a whole, wearing your crowdfunding association hat? I mean, it's gone terribly well so far. There haven't been a number of cock-ups. One of the things that I've been told by many people over the last 6 months is that you've got to be careful, especially in equity crowdfunding, because there are a few spivs out there who don't have the reputation of the lead players. How's the market going to evolve in 2015?
Well, I think you've kind of touched on what I'd say with a couple of main risks or challenges to crowdfunding over the next few years. If you asked me a year ago, I'd probably say the regulation, just because we didn't know whether the FCA was going to change its view. That still might change when they relook at things in 2016. The thing that people might say now, or certainly an outsider when looking at crowdfunding, is fraud. You know, how do you stop an entrepreneur running off with the money?
Which has happened in China with many of their P2P crises.
Yeah, it's happened in a few Ponzi places, and you see this quite a bit on the rewards platform. So I think the likes of Kickstarter have had a few issues when people haven't, you know, either sent the prizes that you're supposed to get on Kickstarter or used the process in the right way. But so far on the equity side, there's been very little, if at all, fraud. And I think one of the reasons for that is that everything is so transparent and so visual that you can see what people are doing all the time in this sort of online world. Another way that CEDARS obviously protects against that is in this subscription agreement that we enter as nominee, there are a number of sort of contractual rights that we can take action using if an entrepreneur doesn't use the proceeds that they raise in the way that they say they're going to do. And there's a number of sort of contractual warranties that I won't bore you with that if they breach.
So this is why you're stuffed full of lawyers, because someone needs to track all this stuff.
Exactly. And let's hope we never need to use it, but they're there if we need them to. And then the third point, which you touched on, really is what happens when one of the platforms, as opposed to one of the businesses, really stuffs up. And we'll start to see some failures in the next few years, I expect, from, you know, breach of regulation or even just people not getting what they thought they were going to get when they invested through the platform. And the obvious point on that is returns. So if an investor buys B shares, expects to get a return, the company they invest in does incredibly well, but they get nothing because of some complicated structure that has developed since they invested, that will be a real tragedy to the industry. And from a UK crowdfunding perspective, that's something that we've actually got to try and take a bit of a role in, disaster recovery plan, a response pack. And it's something that the FCA probably need to start looking at. They're very much focused on the upfront investor journey as opposed to what happens at the end.
Yeah, I think that's quite a good summary. I'd agree with everything you say. So there's a lot to be done by the companies themselves. I mean, obviously the reputable ones try and keep ahead of the curve rather than behind it. There's a lot to be done by the associations, and there's a lot still to be done by the FCA, and it evolves over time. So time's moving on. Let's just touch on CEDARS a little bit. We mentioned before that you've got an acquisition in America, and we also mentioned before that equity crowdfunding is a bit illegal in America, so have you mistakenly acquired an illegal outfit?
A little bit illegal is always a
little
good
bit
phrase,
illegal, yeah,
like
sexy.
Like a little bit pregnant. I don't think anyone wants to be either. I've mentioned the US regulations. At the moment, crowdfunding is only possible with accredited investors. So if you're worth £1 million, or if you make, I made your mistake, worth a million dollars, or making $200,000. If you're rich, you can invest.
Well, that's the rule of America, isn't it?
Well, yeah. And Jobs Act Title III was due to come in last year. And Title III was supposed to affect the type of crowdfunding that we had in the UK. So for your normal non-accredited investor, that is still taking some time. And there's been sort of several rounds of discussions and drafts. And actually, our CEO, Jeff, testified in front of US Congress last year to sort of tell them how to do crowdfunding.
And did they listen to him?
Well, we don't know yet, but we still hope that Title III will have some sensible propositions in it. But the reason we've acquired the US entity is first to take advantage of the accredited investor funding that's there, because there's still a huge amount of capital around.
And people like Angel's List have been going pretty successfully for a while on a similar basis,
exactly.
I understand. Yeah.
Yes. But then also to prepare ourselves for when Title III comes in, and hopefully we can do the same kind of thing that we're doing in the UK.
And when's that currently expected?
Who knows?
Okay, so as long as a piece of string. And so talking of CEDARS, you're very successful. I mean, the reputation in the marketplace is that if you draw a triangle, there's three vertices in the triangle, one vertex, the nasty end is all the spivs and people you really shouldn't be trusting. Another vertex is the people who are extremely professional and thorough. And then the other vertex is pile them high and sell them cheap. And I don't think that any firm exists purely at one of the vertices. They're somewhere in the triangle. But CEDARS has always had the reputation, everyone spoke to me, about being sort of very professional, very solid, very grown up, but not necessarily very cheap. So in terms of these various structures, you charge both sides, don't you, on the way in and the way out?
Yeah, so we do charge on the way in and the way out.
Which is anomalous, is it, compared to the industry as a whole?
Generally anomalous, yeah. I think there are a couple of other platforms which do a similar thing, and I'll explain why. The reason that on the very, very large majority of platforms there's only one fee is because they only do a service for one person.
At that point in time.
For the business. Yeah. So when the business raises money, generally, the approach is to charge a percentage of the funds raised as the fee. Now, at CEDARS and other platforms that operate a nominee structure, you will also perform a service for the investors. So you hold their shares, yeah. You act on their behalf. Yeah. Therefore, we charge the investor too on any profit that they make.
Right. So just for the avoidance of doubt, your ice cream company comes along, raises its money, and it pays a fee to CEDARS for raising the money, and the investors don't. Investors have got their investment in ice cream company, which in 10 years' time does a $1 billion IPO. And at that point, you take a percentage of their capital profit. Is that right?
Exactly. So both fees are success driven. The entrepreneur only pays when they raise their money, when they successfully raise their money. There's no pay to pitch. There's no hidden legal or payment provider fees like you might have on other platforms. It's just that one fee, a percentage of what they raise. And the investor fee is also a success fee. So it's only if they make money, get more than their capital investment back, that we take a percentage on that.
Right. So they only pay on success is an interesting point, isn't it? Does everybody do that?
I think most do, but I'm sure there are some out there which do. The traditional model is obviously pay to pitch.
Yeah, I can think of a friend who incurred various expenses and never actually raised money on his platform, which turned out not to be regulated. It's another story entirely. But that also means from a business process perspective that you need to have some fairly sensible filters in, because otherwise, if you have any idiot like me on the London FinTech podcast wants to raise a million and you do loads of work, and then not even my mum invests, you're going to end up doing loads of work for a bunch of people and making no money.
Yes, and that is a risk that you take. And, I mean, you've got to balance that risk with not casting judgment on someone else's business.
Exactly, so that's quite tricky in practice.
And again, different platforms take a different approach to this. So some platforms do a lot more vetting early stage, and some even run mini incubator programs to get them into the best possible position. Yeah. And as a result, few of their companies fail. But with us, we look at the company when it comes to us with its idea, we look at its market, what it's going to do, make sure we can verify everything as fair, clear and not misleading in their campaign. So there's a fair bit of upfront work to do. But if the entrepreneur seems like it has some drive, seems like it's got a really interesting product or really interesting strategy, then why shouldn't they be able to raise on seeders and see how they do? They're getting better and better. At the beginning, we had a lot more failures, I think, because there were a lot more people just having a go. But as the quality has increased, so have the people that have come to us.
Oh, interesting. And also, it's a reputational point as well.
I think so.
And you're also saying, I mean, it's a long time since I was involved with stock exchanges and listings and valuations, which is a thing we haven't touched on. Maybe we should. But you're also saying that Chapel Wines people, you were cheaper for them anyway than going via their IDX or whatever it was.
I very much suspect so.
So the claim that you guys are at the expensive end isn't necessarily
No, I mean, correct. I think you've just got to look at what we do. And as I think we were talking about earlier, I think there will be a fundamental shift in the next few years on the fees on traditional, you know, EIS fund managers, for example, or other types of asset managers who will have to start justifying what they do for the high fees that they charge, because Seeders is doing it for a really good deal.
Indeed. And also you're doing a package. So back in the day when I was overviewing corporate finance, big companies would turn up and they'd have to pay corporate finance for their IPO or equity fundraising or whatever, and then have to pay a bunch of lawyers and then have to pay a bunch of auditors. And so there's all sorts of people. Whereas, as I understand, you're more of a one-stop shop. So I turn up with my fundraising tomorrow and you do my EIS forms or whatever they are.
Yes, and sometimes that can be quite a headache. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Chapel Down, that's 1,500 EIS forms.
Right, you need a good photocopier.
We actually bought our photocopier upstairs, which is a bit of an industrial machine, before doing the fundraise for Seeders on Seeders last year, end of 2013, where we got 900 investors in us. So we thought we needed a new printer for that.
Right, no, indeed. I quite like that. This recursive idea of Seeders going through Seeders. So valuations is a terribly, 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 terribly tricky thing, because there's no such thing as a valuation. And again, having sat on the committee which decided at what price Gazprom should be listed and Pactel, the Pakistani telephone company, all that kind of thing. On the one hand, you've got the sort of corporate financiers who are saying, oh, well, based on this model, blah, 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 and coming up with a number. On the other hand, you've got the equity guy saying, yeah, well, I don't think people are going to pay 150 pence for it. Maybe they'll pay 145, kind of seat of the pantsy stuff. And then out there in the world, you've got loads of entrepreneurs who think their business is almost worth $1 billion today. How is it, just briefly, how on earth do you get around this valuation conundrum?
Yeah, well, ultimately, we don't advise on valuations, right, and we try and steer clear of that. But in the same breath, when an entrepreneur comes to us with a huge valuation, we will tell them bluntly that it just won't work with our investors, because we've seen it, and we've seen a number of companies who have come on with a very ambitious valuation, not done very well at all, taken the campaign down and relisted for a lower valuation, and suddenly done very well. And investors are far more savvy than you think. They will see a good deal and they'll go for it. And then they'll also just think, well, you know, there are plenty of other companies doing that out there. And you know, certainly the more regular investors on the Seeders platform will have a very good idea of valuations for certain companies. But our main guidance for entrepreneurs is look at comparable companies, see what other companies have raised for, because you're only shooting yourself in the foot by raising too high, because people won't invest in you. And even if they do, it will cause you problems at your later stage rounds if you then have to do a down round.
Absolutely. So just wrapping up, Where do you guys see yourselves being in a year's time or 5 years time?
Big question, Mike, big question.
Well, maybe you don't want to tell me.
As I said, this year, expanding our European operations, taking a real focus in places that we've seen have been very, very interesting, and when we see there's a lot of entrepreneurial growth. I mean, just doing more and more and better deals. I think once the US entity is set up properly, having a look at seeing what's there, getting accredited investors to start moving their money across European deals. We think sort of the transcontinental aspect will be really, really interesting. And seeing if there's more that came from with the Chapel Down raise, seeing if bigger institutions want to start using us.
Well, I think that fits in quite nicely with the theme of my New Year's episode, which is that 2015 is the year that fintech grows up and it certainly needs to mature. And I'm fairly hopeful that there's a possibility that a lot of these important markets like equity, crowdfunding or peer-to-peer can mature successfully. And actually, it's 30 years since I joined the city this month. And thinking back to those days, pre-Big Bang, I think it's little appreciated these days, largely because there aren't so many people who are still active around pre-Big Bang. But pre-Big Bang, there was a structure. There was an ecosystem in modern language which had operated successfully for a century or two. So you had stockbrokers and stock jobbers, and a bit like these associations are forming at the moment, although there's a way to go yet. Basically, they organised it sensibly in everybody's good and for the market's good, because everybody realised that the good of the market was the good of the players. So I think for me that's the exciting thing going forward, is whether your association, wearing your association hat and the FCA, can create a set of rules whereby everybody can play without any disasters. So we shall see. So thank you for that, Karen. Time's flown by and we've covered a huge range of stuff, and I'm sure that people listening have picked up plenty of interest. So thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so grey, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.